Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today. How is it if you have a cat, do you have a little trouble getting your cat into the cage or whatever to see the vet? I can tell you that one time I was taking Tiger and Coco, our two cats, to the vet. I got Tiger in the carrier, and I spent almost an hour trying to find Coco. In fact, I never found Coco. Yeah. And I had to finally take Tiger in all by his lonesome. You may have those kind of problems too. Sandy, do you see that a lot?
Oh, we see that all the time. You know, cats now outnumber dogs when it comes to family pets, but we see fewer cats coming into the vet. And when we've looked at reason why, it's not that they don't feel that they don't need vet care, it's the transportation issues. And so there's a lot of things that we can do at home to make it easier for getting your cat to the veterinarian. And always the first thing is getting the right carrier. Needs to be the right size. I see people cramming these 18-pound cats into these little tiny carriers. I'm like, how in the world could you ever get that cat in there? I did a rabies clinic in Rock County about a month ago and vaccinated about 140 cats in a couple hours. And they all came in carriers because that was the rules. But I saw every size and shape of carrier you'd want to see. But my kind of recommendations, if you're going to be buying a carrier, get a large one, okay, and make sure that it has easy release sides so that you can take the top off. A lot of cats enjoy being at the veterinarian if they can be down in the bottom half of their carrier where they still have some sides to feel like they're protected. And if you've got something that's bolted shut or, you know, doesn't come apart easily, it really makes our life difficult because we have a difficult time getting the cat out of there. We don't like to do I call it the shake and bake, where you take, lift the carrier up and shake, try to get the cat out. That scares the cat. I'd rather be able to take the crate apart. And they now have top loading models too that work really well. If you're bringing more than one cat into the vet clinic, which I never recommend, separate carriers, okay? Because we will see, and it doesn't happen all the time, because I know you bring your cats in and they get along fine, but sometimes we will have cats that get stressed and they feed off of each other. And then when you're trying to go home and you're trying to put them back in the carrier again, they're now confined in this strange space with this other cat that's stressed. So two separate carriers, if at all possible, that will make life very easy for everybody. And ideally, one cat per appointment, because while one cat's getting treated, if they get upset at all, the other cat's going to feed off of it, and we're going to have more problems with that cat too. Leave the cat carrier out all the time.
Yeah, you know, and I leave mine out all the time. They're in there all the time.
Good. Well, and that's just, turning it into a really fun spot. They get treats in there. Maybe if your cat's afraid of it, you can dismantle it so just the lower half's there and it's got a blanket in it, so that it now becomes just a permanent fixture. And you can train the cat to get in their carrier by tossing treats in and, pairing that with the phrase, kennel up or something like that, like we do for dogs. So making it comfy, feeding the cat in it and so on. The blanket that you can leave in it also helps, because a lot of cats, if they get scared, will urinate and then they're sitting in wet carrier. So the blanket may help absorb some of that too. I like solid-sided carriers. The real soft-sided ones, sometimes the cat feels a little more insecure just because the bottom is a little weaker when you're picking it up and carrying it. So the solid carriers work a little bit better. Covering it up with a towel so they can't see the frightening world outside. Using feel away, which is a pheromone that makes cats feel a little calmer. You want to put it in the carrier before you put your cat in, because it's got an alcohol base and it can really be kind of like not smelling good to humans and cats. So put it in there and let it kind of air out a little bit. The pheromone will be left behind. And that may help the cat. Some cats really enjoy catnip, too. And I know I have one of my cats actually gets almost like stoned on catnip. And it's so easy to put him in his carrier then, because he's just like, all right, load me up. And so sometimes using catnip will work, too. And there are times where we have to resort to using drugs. And although I don't like to do it, there's one that I've started to use fairly frequently in cats called gabapentin. It's a medication that a lot of people take for nerve-related pain and so on, but it's very sedating for cats, and they it wears off fairly quickly, and not a lot of side effects, and it we've been having really good success with using that too. So if you have to, we go with that.
You know, one of the things I like about the at the clinic, at your clinic, is there's a separate waiting room for cats versus the dogs, and I think that's quite nice.
That is a very important point. When you're looking for a veterinary clinic to take your cat to, do they have those kind of conveniences, like areas where maybe the cat cage can be up and elevated so you don't have dogs and other people and things looking in the carrier and scaring your cat? And that's why we have a separate cat waiting area. The other thing that we've gone ahead and done at the veterinary school is the primary care doctors, which includes me and three of my colleagues, have all been certified in what's called fear-free practice. And although that's not specifically for cats, it's for cats and dogs, that would be something else to be asking the clinic, have you gone through one of these programs, so that we just kind of learned some of the ways of making the clinic exams so much easier and less stressful for not only our cats and dogs, but also for the owner for getting them in there too.
Okay, so lots of good things to think about. They still won't always like it, but...
But you can learn to burrito your cat. Do you know what I mean by that? Wrapping them in a towel, okay? And there's very good videos on YouTube to show you how to do this. And this would be something you would practice before you go into the vet clinic. And just it becomes just this fun game. It's also helpful for trimming toenails and things like that. But teaching a cat to just sit still while you wrap a towel around them, then you can put the cat wrapped in the towel in the carrier. They can get out of it, obviously, because you're not going to be holding them anymore. But now the cat is confined in the carrier, and it's kind of no muss, no fuss.
There we go. Well, lots of callers online to visit with you, so let's take some calls. And Claudette in Cedarburg, I think, is up first. Claudette, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Lots of good hints and tips there about getting cats into cages. We have solved the whole problem for our two cats by having a vet that comes to the house for regular exams, so we don't have to take them anywhere. Dr. Tom's Veterinary Service will make a house call.
That's wonderful. And not every community has that available to them. And sometimes some of the house call vets, if you've got a cat or a dog that is ill or needs extra care, like maybe x-rays taken or a surgical procedure, still have to be transported to the clinic. And so getting them used to being in a vehicle is really helpful too. So not only getting them used to the carrier, but instead of making the only time they ever go in the car to be going to the veterinary clinic, just go around the block or, you know, make short trips with them. Even stopping at the clinic for just a, you know, come in, say hi to the receptionist, they get a cat treat and out the door they go. We call those friendly pet visits. Really can make all the difference as well. But I'm very glad you were able to find somebody. And when we do have pets that are scared in the car, frightened at the clinic, but fine at home, that's a great alternative.
Thanks again for that call. Jane and Mercer, it's your turn now. Hi, Jane. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. I have a 14-year-old male neutered cat who has been urinating excessively and drinking lots of water. He checked out fine in June for his annual exam. I took him back to the vet when this started. He's fine. She did all the blood work, thyroid, blood sugar, liver, kidney, everything checked out fine. So she said it's nothing to worry about. I'm just kind of calling for a second opinion. But the other part of this is that my two cats, they're both 14 years old. They're litter mates, male and female. Lily had bladder stones a number of years ago, and she's been on Purina UR ever since and never had a problem since. But he also eats the Purina UR dry food.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know will increase thirst and urination, but it's never been a problem before now. So I don't think it's the diet. The vet didn't think it was the diet either, and she said it's fine to keep eating that.
Yeah.
So
it sounds like your vet is right on the ball with doing everything. Probably our top three differentials for cats that are drinking more and urinating more are kidney disease. And unfortunately, when we're doing blood work to detect kidney disease, you won't see changes in the blood work until they've lost a lot of kidney function, usually over 70% of their kidney function. And so there's a new test that's out that a company in Colorado is running, and it's called the S, as in Sam, DMA test. It's not very expensive. I think through our clinic it runs about $18, $19 to run, and it picks up evidence of kidney disease much, much earlier. And I don't know if that's something that your veterinarian considered running or not, but that may be something else if they're okay. Running out of reasons for why your cat may be drinking more and urinating more. Diabetes is one of those other reasons as well. And the fact that they checked blood sugar and hopefully a urine sample and looked at urine sugar too and said, no problem that way. And then the last thing is hyperthyroidism. And we could sometimes see cats that are hyperthyroid drinking more and urinating more. And if the thyroid value is kind of on the high end of the normal range, sometimes early on in the disease, we will see some fluctuation in thyroid levels. And so it's still possible that your cat could be hyperthyroid. There are some other tests that we can do, something called a T3 suppression test that may be helpful. And sometimes it's just a matter of rechecking your cat on a different date to see, you know, is there some fluctuations with that? But there's some things on physical exam that I would hope that your veterinarian would have been able to pick up to indicate with your cat's hyperthyroid, like a heart murmur that wasn't there before, or if you've got a very relaxed cat, you can sometimes feel an enlarged thyroid. It may only be like the size of a lentil. They can be very tiny, but that's big. And you know, so having a cat that's relaxed enough that you can feel in their over their airway for it is another thing to help. And so if the thyroid was a little bit big, but the thyroid value came back normal, I'd be probably looking at, let's recheck that again and see what's going on. But in the meantime, lots and lots of water always available. And make sure that you've got multiple litter boxes in your house. I would recommend at least three if you've got two cats, and at least one on every floor, and making sure that you're cleaning it every day, because your cat doesn't want to have a dirty litter box or have difficulty getting to where the litter boxes are.
Yeah, and that's not been a problem. He's not urinating outside the box.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, that's good.
Because that happens quite frequently. You know, that carpet becomes nice and absorbent. And when you've got a senior cat, it's and the litter boxes are down in the basement, you know, why should I wander all the way down here when the bed that I'm laying on has a beautiful comforter that's nice and absorbent? So you may start having issues like that. So you just want to cover your bases and make sure that that's not going to become a problem as well.
And Chris Molina, our on-air producer, will put up a link on Facebook, on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, to that test you were talking about.
The SDMA, yes.
SDMA.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, and of course, Chris Molina, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Open lines, finally, again. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a pet photo and a question up on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And we've already got a few pet photos up there, nice ones. So that's kind of cool.
Yes, we've got one of a couple of dogs just relaxing and listening to the show here. So
yeah, that's pretty cool. And a couple of kitties.
On their way to the clinic. Yeah, both in the same carrier. I hope that they are still getting along that well on their way home. So, yeah.
Glenn and Stevens Point, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Well, originally it was a dog question, but you could include a cat in it also. I harvest 25 meat chickens every year, and I want to use my innards, my heart, liver, and necks and feet for dog food. So I cook them up in a big cauldron, and I freeze them. And what's your idea about feeding that out to a – I have a 70-pound golden retriever.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that you're cooking it because there's many people that are on to the raw food business, and we worry about not only the dog's health with that, but also human health. The big issue are, you know, bones can sometimes become more brittle and can cause problems. If you are grinding it up so that there is nothing there that is going to be irritating to your dog's intestinal tract, I don't see a lot of problems with feeding that, but I would not use it as my entire diet. That would not be considered a complete and balanced diet because you're not going to be able to have the right calcium phosphorus balance, protein, carbohydrates, all those essential vitamins and things that a dog may need is not going to be in there. There are recipes available that you can follow where they would be recommending, you know, certain numbers of different parts. And I don't know if it would include things like the feet or the necks or anything like that. But there are, you know, places that you can get recipes that would allow you to have a balanced diet. One of the companies that I recommend to pet owners is a group of veterinarians out in California that operate a business called Balance It, and it's balanceit.com. And you can put in the protein type that you want to use, and then they will come up with a recipe for you. And so it would usually be like chicken hearts or chicken liver with, you know, something like vegetables or grain or something like that, along with the different supplements to keep it balanced. So, yeah, I don't think so some precautions, especially with the way you prepare it. And if you're only going to be using it as a supplement, probably fine. But as a whole diet, not going to be effective.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you so much for calling. And it's Catherine in Madison. We're on to you now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. We're having a problem with our dog, Romeo. And
okay.
Romeo, it usually happens in the morning when he gets up. His stomach is like hard as a rock, and it's painful. It's been going on around 6 weeks, and it's happened maybe 4 to 6 times. And it seems to help to massage his stomach, and it doesn't last a long time. And we've had him to the vet, and he poked and prodded and did a X-ray and didn't find anything at all. She checked his prostate, and it was slightly swollen, but not enough to be a problem. So I just wondered if you had any other thoughts.
Is he vomiting at all with these episodes? So no vomiting. When he gets up in the morning, will he eat readily or?
Well, he eats in the evening.
He eats in the evening. Okay, so he just gets one meal a day?
Usually,
meal. Okay. No flatulence or diarrhea or anything like that associated with this?
Not that we've seen.
Okay. Very weird. What kind of dog is Romeo?
He's an Alaskan Husky.
He's a Husky. Okay. So he's a large breed dog.
Mm-hmm.
That's very strange. You know, we do see some morning issues with dogs. There's a condition that dogs get called bilious vomiting syndrome where they get some reflux from their intestinal tract into their stomach. And that bile from their intestinal tract is very irritating. And so often these dogs are nauseated. They may be smacking their lips. You can often hear their stomach grumbling. Do you hear extra noises or anything like that?
No. We wondered if it might be gas or constipation.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that if it was constipation, the symptoms you would see would be straining to pass stool, and that the stool that he would pass would be hard and very dry. Your veterinarian would have been able to probably palpate that on abdominal palpation or with doing a rectal when they were checking his prostate. Feel hard stool. And, you know, we don't see constipation that often in dogs. And the fact that it's occurring this frequently, I'd be more worried about, you know, is it some type of a gas buildup with you feeding him at night before he goes to, or in the evening before he goes to bed? One of the things that you may want to consider doing is just try splitting his meals up into 2 or 3 smaller meals a day, so he's not having one big meal that is sitting in his stomach when he goes to bed. And you may find that will just help with digestion a little bit better, rather, you know, and it may help relieve some of this. But I would think that if you've been feeding him this way all his life, that it would have been a problem all his life. And obviously it hasn't been. So Very, very strange. And I don't know if it's possible for you to, if he's, when he's in this state of being a hard distended abdomen, get him to a veterinarian for an evaluation, or, you know, because that's going to be your best bet to try to get an answer is actually see him as when he's in this state.
Yeah, yeah. This doesn't last that long. What about changes of dog food? Could that be...
Could that help?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, especially if you were to go with something like a low residue, a low fiber dog food that's easier to digest. And that would be something that you could get from your veterinarian. They're called enteric diets. They're usually a low fat, low fiber diet. And there's one called EN that Purina makes. There's one called ID. There's low residue. There's a number of them on the market. And that might be worth a trial just since this seems to be happening more frequently over the last few weeks.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, Jeff in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
You bet. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I have a yellow retriever mix. She's 10 months old, and I had her out hunting over the weekend, and we picked a load of ticks off of her. And then the last night, we picked four or five off, and they were infected. And they were pussy. And they got the red circles around them pretty bad. Now, she's been, she's got the Lyme's vaccination this spring. But I'm wondering, is this something, can I let it sit for a couple of days and see how it goes?
What are you using for your tick control?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I just use a collar.
What kind of collar?
I think it's, I don't really recall. I picked it up from Farm and Fleet.
Okay. Did you pay like under $10 for it?
Yep.
That's garbage. Throw it out, okay?
I know. They worked in the past, but usually on the dog that was been around the house a lot, around the yard.
And they probably had fewer ticks. Now you've got your dog out in the field, and the tick population in Wisconsin is getting worse and worse and worse every year.
It's terrible.
I would be – a couple of things I'd be recommending. Number one – the ticks that you are pulling off your dog, it would not be a bad idea to have them evaluated by your veterinarian. Just a quick look, a technician could tell you what kind of ticks they are, okay? Because if they're the standard wood tick, there's very few diseases that they're going to carry that we get concerned about. But if they're deer ticks, we get more concerned. And just assuming that because she's been vaccinated for Lyme disease doesn't mean that she's going to be protected from all the other tick diseases that are out there. We're seeing equal number of cases of another disease called anaplasma that can be actually worse for the dog in some ways because it can affect the bone marrow and the joints and cause fever. And we don't have a vaccine for that. So practicing, really, this is the time of the year where tick control is vital. I mean, we need to use it. Deer ticks love the 30 to 40 degree temperature type range. And so you really need year-round tick control when you live in this area because we have weather sometimes in January and February where it's in the 30s and 40s, maybe snow on the ground, but you can still have a tick bloom. Right. And so things that to be talking to your veterinarian about, if you want to use a collar, I would recommend something called the Seresto collar. The Bayer company makes it. It lasts for 8 months unless they're in the water a lot, and then it loses its efficacy more quickly. But that is a very effective collar. I'm also quite fond of all the oral flea and tick products that are out there now. They are prescription. There's one called NexGard, another Bravecto, and another one called Simparica. And they all work very similarly. One lasts for 3 months. The other two of them last for 1 month. And you just give it like you do your heartworm preventative on a monthly basis. And that's very easy and works quite well. I would also be recommending that, you know, if you get those ticks checked, you may want to talk to your veterinarian about either prophylactically putting your dog on a round of doxycycline, which is the antibiotic we use to treat some of the tick-borne diseases, just in case, because it sounds like she was really loaded with them and they were on there feeding and had time to transmit disease, making sure that those areas are probably just, I would just treat topically with some Neosporin or something just to keep them, get them protected. We rarely ever see the like bullseye type thing that people get on dogs. So the what you're seeing is likely just the local reaction around where the tick was feeding. And then talking to your veterinarian about screening for Lyme and anaplasma and the other disease called Ehrlichia. It can take 3 or 4 weeks before they become positive for those diseases. So I would be looking at probably doing that, you know, down the road a little bit.
There we go. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post a photo or question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Leslie in Elgin, Illinois next. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I take care of about 4 feral cats.
Okay.
And I've been doing it for about 3 years. I had them all spayed and neutered. I did a live trap and I had them caught. They got spayed and neutered, got their rabies shots and all that. But it's been 3 years. I can only touch 2 of them, so 2 of them I have been able to get some flea medicine on. The other 2 I can't touch, and even the 2 I can touch, if I tried to kennel them, it would be chaotic. What do I do? Do I worry about getting them back in for more updates on rabies? Is there a trick?
Yeah, well, anyway, I'm just actually, as you were talking, I was pulling up, there's a really wonderful website out there now that's called rabiesaware.org. It's a national website that looks at rabies laws and vaccination laws in the United States. And Illinois is, it's only the law to vaccinate dogs, not cats. But you also have to look at local ordinance, because even though the state law says that dogs have to be vaccinated, your local ordinance may say, yes, they have to be vaccinated. And that's going to be a problem. How do we do that? And I'd be looking at, you know, live trapping, if possible. I had several cats come in during this rabies clinic that I did that were, you know, barn cats that were caught that way. And we were able to just get them vaccinated through the live trap without even getting them out and or touching them. So there are ways of being able to do that. And I think for, you know, your liability, since you are caring for these cats on your property, even though you can't touch them, they are still, it's, you know, your liability to make sure that they are current on their vaccines, because if they were to bite or scratch somebody, then it's on your head to be able to prove that they've been vaccinated for rabies. So, yeah, so it's a difficult situation when we're dealing with ferals like this that that are just, you know, hard, difficult to catch and handle. So live trapping would be probably your best bet.
There we go.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Amy and Stevens Point, thank you for calling as well. Hi.
Hi, I am calling because I have an elderly dog. He's a beagle. His name is Milo. And he is going deaf. And I'm wondering how we can really help him, because he can't hear us if we call him to come in or to do things. So if you have any tips or suggestions, I'd really appreciate how to support our dog.
Oh, that's so good that you're looking out for his comfort at this point in his life, because dogs that are deaf are going to startle more easily, and we don't want him to be living in this, you know, always feeling like he's fearful because he never knows when someone's going to be approaching. And so one of the things that they have available for deaf dogs, and you can order them online, are collars that have built into it a little sensor. You have a remote, and it's just a little, like, vibration. And it's kind of like having your phone on vibrate in your pocket. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, somebody's trying to get me, or I can, you know, I kind of look at it as tapping them on the shoulder, like, hey, you know, I'm coming in the room, and so it gives them kind of a little bit of a heads up. This is one of the reasons why a lot of trainers like to teach dogs when they're young hand signals as well as voice cues, because eventually, in many cases, you need to be able to teach hand signals. You can still teach him some hand signals at this point, and I'd be, you know, doing everything we can to just make sure that you use his visual senses. So like when he's out in the backyard at night, hopefully it's fenced and he's not going to be able to wander off because he can't hear traffic or other animals around. Flipping the light switch off and on your, like, back porch light. Sometimes they learn that means, like, oh, I'm supposed to come in. You know, having, when it comes to dinner time, that's, you know, showing him the food or whatever so that he can come running and get his dinner. Again, I don't have exact, you know, solutions for you, but the big thing is just not startling him if you can. And look into getting one of those collars. They're very effective.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure. Yeah, appreciate it, Amy. Thank you. And Sharon and De Pere, we'll give you a thanks as well for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. We lost our golden retriever very suddenly. He was 11, and we were out of town, 8 hours away. He was at a wonderful kennel that we used for years, and the kennel lady called and said, I just took him to the emergency animal care in Green Bay, mm-hmm. and we're driving from Des Moines, Iowa, and we asked if Luther could be saved until we got there, but he died.
Oh, I am so sorry.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had this happen to actually my own pets where healthy and happy, and then all of a sudden, what's going on? And within an hour or two, they're gone. And, you know, in hindsight, having an autopsy done is something that would is going to really help with closure, and it may be too late now to consider having that done.
He is. But we want to know what they said, this whatever condition, and we were in such a state, we still want to talk to our vet.
Yeah.
It's something about his spleen and his cavity filled with blood.
Yeah, probably one of the most common forms of cancer that we see in golden retrievers and other large breed dogs, but goldens are known for this, is a type of cancer that affects blood vessels, and it's called hemangiosarcoma. And you can imagine blood vessels that are cancerous, they're so fragile that, and the spleen is an organ that is just, you know, it's an organ that handles blood.
Yeah.
And so it's a very common spot for these tumors to grow, and they can come up very quickly. I've had dogs where I've looked at them a month or two previously, they were healthy and fine, and they come in pale, large abdomen, big palpable mass that wasn't there a month previously. So it can come on very quickly. And what happens is they just have to lay down a little hard, bump into something, and sometimes nothing happens, but it just, these tumors rupture, they bleed internally, and die very quickly. It's a... Man, I hate to say, but if you had a way to need to die, this is fast and really non-painful. Unfortunately, even if you do catch it early before they've ruptured, they've already spread. And because it's a tumor of blood vessels, even though the chest may be clean of metastasis and you've ultrasounded the rest of the abdomen, most of these dogs, even with chemotherapy, maybe at best live 6 months. And that's, you know, when you're catching it before they've ruptured. So
could you repeat the kind of cancer?
Yes, it's called hemangio, H-E-M-A-N-G-I-O, hemangiosarcoma, S-A-R-C-O-M-A.
Okay, thanks so much.
You are welcome, and again, my condolences.
It's very sorry.
So tough, you know, it's the thing that goldens die of. That's the leading cause is cancer.
Oh, and again, my condolences as well. Thank you, Sharon, for calling. And it's good to know, good for her to know and her husband to know.
Yeah, and that's what I always think of getting an autopsy. I mean, I think it's always worthwhile to help with closure, but I think they had enough answers if that's from the emergency clinic.
Yeah. Thank you again. We'll go to Stephanie and Racine next for a call. Stephanie, hello to you.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
I'm like watching a cat till somebody can find a home for it.
Okay.
And he's been here for a while, and he's like eating a lot, but he's getting skinnier, and he's like licking off his hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering what your thoughts on that would be.
How old is the cat?
I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah, I mentioned earlier in the show this condition called hyperthyroidism, and that is one of the causes that we'll see cats eating a lot. The thyroid gland is involved with metabolism, and when it becomes overactive, the cats will start, you know, even though they're eating, will continue to lose weight. And this cat really needs to be seen by a veterinarian, and I'm not sure what rescue group you're working with. forth. But this would be something that he needs to be seen before he's adopted. We do sometimes see hair coat changes with cats that are hyperthyroid. Typically, they're not itchy. And so I'm wondering if he's got two diseases going on, like maybe he's got seasonal allergies, flea allergy dermatitis. There's a mite that cats get called Demodex that can make them itchy where they'll overgroom. And that may have to be addressed separately. But I think getting him in for a physical, head-to-toe physical exam, a neck palpation to see if you can find a thyroid gland, listening to the heart to see if he has a murmur, getting some blood work done so that we can get to the bottom of this is going to be in his best interest. They will die from hyperthyroidism. If it goes untreated, they usually end up in heart failure, and they just become so cachectic, meaning skinny, that they just never bounce back. So getting him in sooner rather than later, I think, is going to be helpful. And I know you're kind of in a bind because it sounds like you're just kind of fostering him, but many...
Yeah, and I'm also disabled, so I don't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's not through a foster place.
Okay.
Through a person.
Okay. Yeah. Still, I would be recommending that you contact your local shelter, Humane Society. Often groups like that will have funds available. I know down in the area where I live, there's a rescue group in southern Wisconsin that does, you know, help with providing funding for, you know, veterinary services that are urgent like this. And so if there are places out there, it may take a little bit of looking, but contacting local veterinarians, contacting the shelter, and see if you can get him in somewhere. I think that's going to be in his best interest.
Yeah, and good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her with us. She comes by once a month. She's back next month on November 22nd. So that's the next time around. But she's here right now, so we'll take some calls. Beverly in Rushford, Minnesota, it's your turn now. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. I have a German Shepherd that I have had since she was 8 months old, and she is very non-aggressive and sleeps with me every night in my bed. It has never attacked anyone or anything. And all of a sudden, about more than two days ago, going on three now, she has... when I go out to call her in, and it's a small piece of property, she will go halfway down the steps to come down to get to the house, and she looks up at me, she looks up at the house, and it's like, no way am I going into that house. Hmm. And she turns around and she goes the opposite direction.
Okay.
And she will not come into the house. Now, I've put food out for her, hoping that if she's not going to come in, at least she'll eat out there.
Right.
But she's scared. I really think she's scared.
Yeah. And a couple things that I'd be looking into, too, are does she have any vision problems? And so getting her in for a physical exam to have her eyes looked at. There's a condition that German Shepherds get called pannus that affects the eyes and the vision. And so I don't know if anything like that's going on. But just, you know, getting a good overall physical done whenever there's a behavior change, I think would be helpful. And then the other kind of words of wisdom that I live by is that if you can't control the dog, control the environment. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is she should not be able to go out unless you've got her on a leash. And it doesn't have to be a short leash. It could be something long with you on the other end so that you can make coming to you a fun experience so that she can be out sniffing and everything, and then you can ask her to come. Have your pocket filled with something like little cuts up pieces of chicken or some really luscious dog treats or hot dogs or something, and make it a wonderful experience for her that when she comes to you, No, or near the house, and gradually you get closer and closer into the house so that you're then able to make coming into the house a wonderful experience. Something could have happened. I mean, did her tail get caught in the door? Did a smoke alarm go off? Did something scare her to make the house now a scary place? And you may have to, you know, really do some searching to try to figure out what it may be, but we need to make that process of getting back into the house, because winter's on its way, and we don't want her to be staying outside for the, you know, all this time. So, you know, go outside with her, positive reinforcement when she does come to you, and then using the leash to help get her back into the house. And you may even want to try a different entryway, if possible. If it was something that happened at that entryway, it may be a different way getting into the house may be helpful as well.
Could a stray cat outside terrorize her?
Oh, sure. Even though she's a, you know, everybody thinks a big, tough German shepherd, boy, if you had a cat sitting on your porch and it, you know, hissed at her and tried to scratch her, that may be enough for her to say, I'm not coming back up there because there may be that evil cat, you know, hiding in the bushes near the entryway.
They're that smart.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Often there are many dogs that I call one-time learners. Something bad happens once, and they are affected forever because of it. So, and German Shepherds are not known for being dumb dogs. They are some of the smartest dogs that we get to deal with.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we have Matt in Sussex with us next. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Great show again.
Thank you.
I have a couple of little white dogs, and so for years I've kind of been dealing with, they kind of chew at their paws and lick them, and so they're all red, and I've tried a few different things and haven't had a lot of success, so... Yeah. I'm wondering if you can help me out.
Yeah, the red color is coming from the saliva. The saliva contains a chemical called porphyrins, which when exposed to light turns that rusty brown color, which is why you see the red around the mouth and on the feet. Then the big question is, why are they chewing their feet? The number one reason why dogs lick their feet and chew their feet is because they have allergies. We get a runny nose and our eyes itch and we sneeze. Dogs, on the other hand, it's their skin is their allergy organ, and it's usually their feet or their feet in their ears or just their ears, and sometimes it may just be their back feet, just their front feet. There's a lot of variability there, but because they are licking and chewing at them, and they're often inflamed because they have allergies, they are prone to getting secondary yeast and bacterial infections. Mm-hmm. So what I typically do when I get one of these dogs in is examine not only the top of the feet, but flip the feet over and look at the bottoms, kind of spread the pads apart. I will collect some of the material that is there. We'll often use clear Scotch tape. I know it sounds a little strange to put tape on, but that will collect some of that top layer of bugs and skin cells and so on that are there between the toes. And then we stain that and look at it under the microscope to make a diagnosis. Often these dogs need to go on medicated shampoos to treat yeast infections, sometimes oral antibiotics to treat bacterial infections, and then we have to address what's causing the allergies. And we're really lucky in that there's a drug that's been on the market now for a couple of years, but had been in very short supply and now is readily available, and it's called Apoquil. It's a very specific, works on the kind of the nerves that are involved with the itch cycle, and dogs with allergies do very, very well on it. Does not work well for the itch associated with infection, so that's why we have to address that as sometimes a separate issue. But that means, you know, back to the veterinarian and ask them to collect some of that toe jam. So
all right, there we go.
All right, and is that the... Apoquil, is that by prescription only then?
It is a prescription drug. Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
But it works.
It's extremely effective for dogs with allergies. It's really has given a lot of dogs that are allergic their life back. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. And Dan in Laval, on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I got a blue heeler that he's a house dog. And he just wants to roll on his back and scratch his back to no end. And then he'll want to bite at his rear tail area.
Mm-hmm.
And if you scratch him back there, it's just like he's in heaven, you know. So I don't know. We head him to the vet. The vet says that me and the vet have more fleas than the dog does. He's on front line, and he thinks that it might be some sort of an allergy. I don't know. We give him something, but it doesn't seem to help.
Okay. Did they do a rectal exam on him when you had him there?
No.
No. There are glandular tissue on either side of the rectum. They're called anal sacs, or sometimes we'll call them anal glands. Mm-hmm. And sometimes dogs that have that as an issue, most dogs that have that as a problem will scoot, put their bottom on the ground and rub it on the ground. But others will just, reach back there and lick and chew and so on. So that would be something that I'd be looking into. I'd also be, if your dog is a scavenger at all, we'll sometimes see dogs having that kind of hind end itchiness with tapeworms as well. And so dogs that either have had fleas, because fleas can be the intermediate stage of tapeworms, and can hold the cyst stage of the tapeworm, but mice and rabbits and so on do as well. And so sometimes we need to just therapeutically deworm these dogs, because you don't see tapeworms on a stool check. You have to actually witness the segments on the surface of the stool or in the hair around the rectum. But going back to, you know, your veterinarian saying, well, it doesn't have fleas. All it takes is, if a dog has flea allergies, one flea bite to trigger them to be very, very itchy. Frontline's very effective. Just make sure you're applying it appropriately. It needs to be on the skin, not on the hair, and you're using it at the right dose. Also be having your veterinarian look for, like the last caller, secondary infections. We do sometimes see dogs, especially short-haired dogs, that will get staph infections on their back, and it will present sometimes as scaling, little circular patches of hair loss that can be very, very itchy as well. So number of things to kind of go back to the drawing board on and see if we can get this under control.
He's about due for shots again, so we'll have another round with that deal.
Well, he'll look forward to that appointment, because he'll get the rubber glove treatment. So
there you go. Thanks a lot, Dan, for calling. And let's see what Megan has for us in Oconomowoc. Hi, Megan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I have an almost 8-month-old Great Dane, and I've been thinking about having the procedure done that tacks the stomach into place so it doesn't have that bloat and flip.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
I think it's a great idea. Now, is your puppy a boy or a girl?
It's a boy.
Okay. When it's a girl, it's a kind of a no-brainer. We will do often in these large breed dogs laparoscopic spays, and then we can do a gastropexy at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
For males, then, you know, it just means you've got a separate surgery to be able to have that done. But it can be done, tacking can be done laparoscopically, so it's mm-hmm. not a very invasive surgery at all. It's still done under general anesthetic, but it's done with a scope, and they have very tiny, couple of little tiny incisions. But I think it's a great preventive thing to do for any of these deep-chested dogs. I recommend it for, you know, Irish setters, standard poodles, Great Danes, you know, any of these big deep-chested dogs, I think, would really benefit from it.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for calling. And Shane in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
So I was calling about my cat. I've been trying to trim her nails recently, and she just refuses to sit still. You try to hold her. She hates you grabbing her paws. She, you know, pulls away. And she's about 1.5 years old now, and it's been a real problem. And she's started to actually, like, bite at her nails and bite the tips off.
Okay.
And so I wonder if there are any tips for me to make her more comfortable with trimming the nails and everything.
Yeah. So, some of the things that I do is just have them sit. I call it sitting Buddha style, but sitting so that their back is against your stomach and you're sitting in a chair. And so their little legs are pointing straight out, but you don't want to be dislocating their shoulder or actually actually pulling at their feet, and just having them sitting like that, having someone with a spoon or something with something really yummy on it, like some of the, you know, high-end canned cat food or baby food, and having you just touch the feet, just touching them. And they learn to sit like that, and you're not pulling on the feet, you're just touching the feet. And then eventually, you know, again, having the cat just sitting without their legs being extracted away from their body, you can start very gradually maybe trimming a nail or two while they're eating something. So obviously this is something that takes more than one person, and sometimes even three people, one to feed, one to trim, and one to, you know, just hold the cat and keep the cat comfortable. Look into also having, again, I mentioned this earlier in the show, burritoing your cat. YouTube videos on how to do that. Probably a modified scarf technique with a front leg out. You can practice with one foot and then redo it again with the other foot. Will help get your cat comfortable with having this done with little struggle.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we had Marcus on Facebook writing, I have two Siamese cats, 11 years old. One has started pooping outside the litter box. My vet said to get another box, so I now have three of them. They are cleaned regularly, so is it a behavioral or a medical issue?
Yeah, an 11-year-old cat, rule out a medical problem. Impacted anal glands, constipation, things like that that could make defecating painful, that needs to be looked into. So physical exams, a little bit of blood work, kind of go down that path before you say it's going to be just a behavior problem.
Yeah, things to think about. Yeah, and Reggie, the red dog, was diagnosed with chondrosarcoma a year ago. We had the tumor removed. This is on Facebook from Gene. And he's doing great. It's a scary diagnosis, but there are some positive outcomes. We also got him a puppy in January, and they're having a great time together. And
what a lovely picture. And I had a dog called Lumpy that I fostered and that had chondrosarcoma, and he lived with it for a long time before it spread.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to take a quick look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we'll be back with Sandy. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about your pet's health today. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and certainly if you have questions, join in. I think there's one open line at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And if you got a nice photo of your pet, we always love to see that as well, and you can post it right there on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. In the meantime, we'll turn to Denny in Prentice. Denny, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing. What can we do for you?
I've got a 12-year-old Boston rat. Last Tuesday, she ended up lame on her left front foot. I took her to the vet. I couldn't get in until Wednesday. They did a Lyme test on her. She tested negative, but they treated her for Lyme's anyway. By Friday morning, she was 100%. Sunday, she started drinking water like crazy. You could fill her water bowl up, she'd drink it, look at you, give me some more. And as soon as she lays down, she starts peeing and it passes right through her. But she can't stop drinking, so we had to stop giving her water. Well, we called the vet. They want a sample of her urine. My wife and right now going to get the sample of urine. And we can't figure out what is it from her medication that she was on, or... You know, we're going to find out more, but we're just wondering what you thought.
Yeah, what medication is she on right now?
She's on nothing right now. She was treated for 7 days.
7 days, and do you know what the drug was that she was treated with?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
There are some drugs, and I would doubt that your veterinarian would treat Lyme disease. And just because she tested positive, and just because she was lame... on a leg doesn't confirm the diagnosis of Lyme disease. I mean, we are suspicious of it. Well, she tested negative, but not all lameness is due to Lyme. Typically, the treatment that's used is doxycycline, which is an antibiotic. There are some drugs that if the dog is lame, your veterinarian may have pulled out a steroid or something that It can make them drink more and urinate more. But if your veterinarian is suspicious of Lyme disease, probably the worst form of Lyme disease that affects dogs is something called Lyme nephritis, where the Lyme organism actually affects the kidneys and causes the dog to go into kidney failure. And that may be why your veterinarian is wanting to check a urine sample just to be able to see, is your dog spilling a lot of protein in the urine? What's the concentrating ability of the kidneys? And so I think getting that in would be a good idea. But I also think getting the dog in to have some blood chemistry run would be helpful as well, to look at not only kidney values, liver values, sugar, that kind of thing, to rule out other things that can cause your dog to be drinking and urinating more. But it sounds very, very strange. And I'd be, one, questioning the medication, and then, is this really Lyme disease? And if it is, the sooner you can get your dog in and treated, the better. And typically a week of doxycycline is not enough for treating Lyme disease. Usually looking at 3 to 4 weeks, usually a month we put them on.
Okay. Good luck.
Okay. Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And we had a listener who was wondering if you could repeat the medicine you recommend for dog allergies.
It's called Apoquil, and it's spelled Apoquil, and it's called a JAK kinase inhibitor. It is a prescription drug. The first 2 weeks they're on it, they have to be on it twice a day, and then it drops down to once a day. And dogs tolerate it very well. It's fairly inexpensive. It runs about $1 a day kind of on average for dogs. So it's, it is something that I think people that have dogs with confirmed allergies and they don't have secondary infections that need to be treated would be something to talk to your veterinarian about.
And we'll, Chris will post that up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well, the Apoquil. Kim in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Kim. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What can we do for you?
So I've heard a lot of conflicting information about male cats and bladder issues. I've had vets tell me different things. I've had people at different pet stores tell me different things. The first vet that I talked to said that I should have grain-free food and more natural food. And then another vet said that I should get the food from the vet. My cat is 7. When he was 3, he started having bladder crystals. And so I have him in the morning on canned food, which is the CD, something, the veterinary food. And then at night, I try to give him dry food just because, because it's cheaper. I know that that's whatever. But but the one cat, first of all, he's got bladder issues. And then I think he has allergies to some foods. I was feeding some Purina One urinary food for a while, and he would pull all of his hair off underneath his arms and then his chest.
Oh my goodness!
And he's so picky. He's so picky. So I had to start feeding him that food with the Fromm food. He really likes Fromm food, but. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to feed him. It's driving me crazy.
Yeah, and the dilemma that I have with helping you is, what was your cat diagnosed with? There are, depending on the type of crystals, first of all, crystals get overdiagnosed. If you take a urine sample from any normal cat and put it on the counter and let it come to room temperature, because it's so concentrated, minerals come out of solution and form crystals. And so you really need to look at kind of a hot off the press sample. But if your cat was diagnosed with bladder stones, different story. They're big. You can see them on an x-ray. They can cause issues for the cat. And so knowing what kind of crystals or stones the cat has will help direct what you need to feed your cat, because some types of stones like to form in an acid environment. Some like to form in an alkaline environment, which is why many of the therapeutic diets out there that you can get through a veterinary clinic are kind of like the CD diet that Hills makes. You can find it's called CD Multicare, meaning that it's kind of an average pH and it handles both calcium oxalate and struvite crystals as a problem. And now we've got the other issue, too, is we'll see a lot of cats developing sterile cystitis, where they end up developing, having bloody urine and so on. It's not an infection. It's not due to crystals. It's just the bladder wall becoming inflamed. And so now we've got diets out that are actually labeled for treating sterile cystitis, or fluted, that we is what we call it in cats. So my hands are tied a little bit to say what would be the best thing that you can feed your cat. But I will still just say that probably the best thing is anything that's got a lot of water in it, okay? Because if you've got a cat that's had sterile cystitis or any of the crystal problems, water is going to make all the difference, because it's going to make them urinate more, and that's going to help keep everything flushed out. So that's the one word, you know, piece of advice I can give. But without actually seeing your cat's medical record, this is a tough one, and I think so many cats get misdiagnosed or overdiagnosed just because of the way the urine sample's handled, that owners are then feeding their cat a diet for the rest of the cat's life that they may not necessarily need. So, time to go back to the first vet that made the diagnosis and say, what exactly did my cat have, and how did you handle that urine sample? It may come down to, you know, just starting from scratch again and getting a current urine sample check to see where your cat stands.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, good luck.
So I wish I could answer you, but it's not all urinary diets are created equal, and it really depends on the diagnosis.
And that urine sample should, as you're saying, should be taken right at the clinic.
At the vet clinic would be ideal. And so what that would mean is having him go in a carrier with a full bladder, and they just lay him on his side, and we take a very fine needle and go into the bladder, through the bladder wall, and aspirate the urine right out and run it to the lab and have a look at it.
Yeah, there you go.
What are your opinions on like the raw food or the grain-free food and stuff?
You got
like
a couple of hours? Okay. Noelle, the grain-free diet started as a fad at the same time that the gluten-free diet started for people. And for cats, it does make sense because cats are carnivores. But grains can be, as long as they're cooked, can be part of a balanced diet for them. There are no dry cat foods on the market that don't contain carbohydrates. And I think people say, I don't want grains, but are grains actually less healthy than the sweet potatoes or the other things that may be put in there to act as a binding agent to be able to be a carbohydrate to hold it together? That's a good question. I mean, I don't think grain-free diets are necessarily better, but, you know, are you paying more for a diet that your cat doesn't actually need?
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Eric in Portage, thank you for calling. Hi.
Larry, Sandy, it's a pleasure to hear from you both.
Thank you.
Yep. So I have a six-and-a-half-year-old Australian cattle dog who's been living in my house for the last 5 years. She was pretty beautiful when we got her, but we loved her to being a good dog. And she does everything we ask her to do. She's come along really well. But lately, she's been leaving little, like small grape-sized turds in the hallway.
Huh.
And, you know, she's healthy. We vet her a lot. And we feed her really good dog food. We don't mess around. But I think it's emotional because, you know, I go out of town to work a lot. But suddenly my wife said, oh, yeah, but for a week. And then we talked to her about it. And she feels really guilty. And she doesn't do it for about a week, and then she'll do it again every night for a week. My wife will end up stepping in them. They're healthy little poops. They're just, and she poops normally in the yard. She's, you know, and she's healthy about that. She can hold her stuff for 24 hours if she has to. You know, she's not. She always goes off way in the field and takes care of that. But she, like every night for a week, she'll like leave a little tiny. It's always the same size little thing too. So it's not like she's overfilled or anything?
Yeah, and if it's just a small little piece, I worry about fecal incontinence. Sometimes we will see this happen as dogs get older. She's not that old, but I'd be looking at, is does she have, you know, it needs to have a rectal done. Does she have a weak anal sphincter, some type of neurologic problem that's causing her to leak a small amount of fecal material out, at especially at night? I don't know if she sleeps in the hallway or any, you know, because that would be, you know, sometimes when they're sleeping, they'll leak a little bit of urine or leak a little bit of stool. That's probably the most common time that we'll see it. I think one of the things that I would be recommending that you don't do is talk to her about it, okay? They don't understand, especially if it's an involuntary thing like incontinence where she has no control over it. You pointing to it or talking to her about pooping in the hallway is just going to create a stressful situation for her because you're angry and your wife has stepped in the droppings and, you know, and it's after the fact. And after the fact, discussions, whether that be with raised voice or pointed fingers or whatever you may do, is just going to create a dog that's going to be more anxious, and that's not going to make their life very happy. So the only time you can do that kind of training is when you catch the dog in the act, and that's when you can say no and get the dog outside. But again, if it's involuntary, like being fecal incontinent, then we just need to be understanding. And she may need to wear a diaper or something if that's the case. But I would be recommending getting to the bottom of why is she incontinent?
Yeah. There you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, Chris in Madison has a question, too. Here's Chris. Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 7-year-old German Shorthair Pointer, and we have probably been working on about a 2-year on-and-off recurring ear infection. You know, over the course of that probably 2-year period, I bring him into the vet regularly. At one point, they said he had rods on his ears. We've medicated and took care of that. But I'm now flushing his ears probably once a week, and cleaning them at least weekly, and he'll go a month of fine, and then all of a sudden the infection is back for a month, and I'll have to continue with the medication. So my question is twofold. A, do you have any recommendations? And then B, do you have a recommendation for a home ear flush solution or a home remedy that will help save me a little money, because buying ear flushes gets very expensive?
Yeah. I mean, when we have dogs with recurrent ear infections, one of the common reasons for it is allergies. And so that may be the underlying problem, is that we've got just an inflamed ear because your dog has allergies, and that allows yeast and bacteria to grow. So typically when we get these chronic ear infections in, we will do cytology, which it sounds like your veterinarian has done, which means taking a swab, smearing it out on a slide, and seeing what the organisms are. When we see, especially in cases where the bacteria are rod-shaped bacteria, those tend to be the ones that tend to be more resistant to a lot of the antibiotics and things that we may use. And so we'll often do a culture to make sure that we are using the appropriate antibiotic and treating long enough. And often we have to use systemic antibiotics, meaning giving them orally for a good month, sometimes as long as 6 weeks, to get something under control. Once the ear has been cleaned out at the veterinary clinic, having a look to make sure that the eardrum is intact. Sometimes we'll see these dogs that have chronic middle ear infections that just keep receding. And we have to, you know, and when I have a case like that, I'll often refer them to our dermatology staff, where they will do often a CT scan of the dog's skull to be able to see if we've got middle ear involvement. And then they will go in with a video otoscope while the dog's asleep, and be able to get in there and clean it and do everything appropriately. And so these can sometimes be very frustrating, expensive cases to treat. But, you know, I wouldn't give up on it. It sounds like you're really working hard on it. But this may be a case where your veterinarian is going to say, I need to send you to a dermatologist to try to get, you know, a better handle on this. Because if it's going on for 2 years, something's being missed that needs to be addressed. The other thing that needs to be looked into is, does your dog have ear mites? Ear mites in cats, they present very classically kind of a brown, crumbly material. In dogs, we see it all over the place. It can look like a bacterial infection, but they may have yeats, mites there. They're often in very small numbers. And so sometimes I will just treat for mites, which means using a product like Revolution, Advantage Multi, applied, and this is stuff that's used for heartworm preventative, but also gets ear mites, and it's applied monthly on their back, and that helps some of these dogs. And it's kind of just to get that off the table if on doing your swabs you're not finding any evidence of ear mites. But when it comes to what to recommend, boy, I'd have to know what's going on in your dog's ear canal, because if it's inflamed, if it's raw, you don't want to use any ear cleaners or flushes that have alcohol in them. Many of them do. There's, you know, some that are better than others that are on the market. What are you currently using? Which flush?
I use it's a brand new one. The doctor said it's Ear Max, maybe. I just received it.
Okay.
It's literally $25 for about a 10-ounce bottle.
Yeah. I mean, there's some that have antifungal properties. There's some that mm-hmm. will help with bacteria. There's a Tris EDTA flush that we like to use. But again, it's going to come down to what is the diagnosis. If there's yeast and bacteria there, you got to pick the right ear flush to be able to use. So I can't answer your question without having your veterinary records in front of me.
That's okay. One question about food and allergies. We've gone down the allergy route, haven't gone as far as an allergy test, certainly have done food isolation tests. She's on a kangaroo diet now, kangaroo and oat diet,
mm-hmm.
Because it was recommended that probably he's allergic to chicken, which is in every dog food.
Yeah.
But that, again, doesn't seem to help. Is it? You're suggesting it's probably more than just a basic food allergy?
Well, food allergies account for a very small percentage of the allergies that we see in dogs, probably about 15%. Most of the dogs that have allergies are going to be environmental allergies to things like molds, pollens, house dust mites,
your carpet.
Everything like that. That's where allergy testing may be helpful to get that under control. You may also want to talk to your veterinarian about a trial if there is no infection there, but the ears are just red and inflamed, of just using a steroid eardrop in your dog's ear to keep it under control. Our pharmacist makes up dexamethasone eardrops that are just a steroid without antibiotic, without antifungal agents in it, and they're well tolerated by dogs. And maybe going back to that drug that we mentioned earlier in the show called Apoquil, which helps with itching and dealing with inflammation associated with infection.
All right.
Yeah, we're doing Otomax, I believe, is the steroid.
Okay, and Otomax is an antibiotic, antifungal steroid preparation.
Yeah.
And but if there isn't any bugs there, you could get by with a much less expensive, just a steroid ear preparation.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jane says, we have a cat who gets car sick. She's okay for the first 10 minutes or so, but then she empties her stomach and her bowels. The vet's office is an hour away. We've been putting a litter box in the crate for her, but anything else? Any other tips?
Yeah, a couple things. One, don't feed your cat. I would be holding them off food, maybe not giving them breakfast on the day that you're going into the vet clinic. I would also be looking at maybe some anti-nausea drugs, especially if the cat is vomiting. There's a drug called Serenia that we use. It's given orally for car sickness, and that lasts for 24 hours and very safe to use, and that may make the trip a little bit easier. And start with small trips around the block and get the cat used to it before you're in the car for a whole hour and having this, because, you know, it may be the motion sickness, but it could just be straight fear that's making this cat do all of this.
And in about 20 seconds, Dorothy has a puppy eating rocks in the driveway. Could that be a problem?
Oh, definitely. It can break teeth and also act as foreign body. If they swallow enough of them, they can impact the intestinal tract and stomach. So I'd be out there with the dog on a leash and collar harness and redirecting the dog to other things, such as like a ball or something like that that you can play with, and try to get them, keep them from eating those rocks.
Sandy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
You're back November 22nd.
Yeah, right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so, there we go. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, back on November 22nd. Tomorrow we'll be taking a look at the Natural Heritage Conservation Bureau. Stay with us for that, and stay tuned. We've got lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.